This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey everyone, I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
Hi everyone, I'm Gemma Jones, an improvement coach based in the UK and very proud to work with the team at Baptist.
Today we have a very special guest, Jennifer Contongale. And Jennifer, I'm sure I messed your last name up, but if you would, please tell our audience a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Yeah, thanks, Skip. So I'm Jennifer Contongale. I am a continuous improvement coach based in Kampala, Uganda, and I currently work for Medical Teams International. So I work with our country offices, building our CI culture and our processes across the globe. I have about 15 years experience in nonprofits. And the fun part is I kind of applied continuous improvement principles intuitively before realizing about 7 years ago, hey, there's this whole discipline. There's this whole world and framework that people actually use. These are my people. And so that was really lovely. My first introduction was to Lean and then later Kata. And so now I'm able to use the things I've learned to help explain and shape others and their improvement projects. So maybe just a little bit about Medical Teams International. We are a health and nutrition organization, primarily serving communities in humanitarian settings. So what does that mean? That is usually somewhere where the healthcare system has been disrupted, where access to primary healthcare is either limited or non-existent, and outside assistance is required. So a lot of the folks we work with, they might be internally displaced, they might be homeless, they might be refugees, they might be migrants, but really it's those vulnerable populations. So our main focus is on saving lives, on reducing suffering, and through healthcare, restoring dignity for them. So we both staff clinics ourselves, but we also do community outreach and work with the local health partners as well.
This is wonderful, Jennifer. I'm so excited that we're talking to you about this today. I wonder if, you know, a lot of our listeners will be familiar with continuous improvement as it pertains to healthcare. But I'm really interested in the difference, the nuances about humanitarian healthcare. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, great point. So definitely in our sphere, you know, it is not about profit. It is not about making money. It is about how can we give someone the basic level of care to first keep them alive, but then help them to thrive. And so where we are working, those health systems are usually disrupted in some way. Some part of it's not working well. There's a high need from the population, and we often have very limited funding, right? So a lot of our funding comes from either other governments, the UN, individual philanthropy, corporates or foundations. But, you know, the folks who are using our services, they are not paying for it themselves most of the time. So we have to make do with what we have with our funding. And I think probably the hallmark principle is that we have constant uncertainty, right? Like I would imagine, Brad, if you come into work on a Monday at Baptist, you generally know what your office is going to be like, what the tone of the building is going to be like, whatnot. Whereas our staff might be like, hey, we had a big security change over the weekend, or this political situation changed, or those medicines we thought we'd get through did not get through customs. Like, so we are constantly dealing with those sorts of uncertainties. And so I think that sort of constant need to adapt makes it really interesting in terms of how you practice continuous improvement.
Jennifer, I'm really excited for our dialogue this morning. I think that one of the things that we talk about a lot and that I'm searching for a lot today is the people that have that light bulb moment of like, oh my goodness, I have to use continuous improvement to help me get the results that I'm looking for. You kind of said you had that aha. So I want to dig in a little bit there. Can you explain more about kind of when and why you found continuous improvement as something you know you had to use?
That's a really good question. Yeah. So I think it can be easy to scattershot, right? It can be easy to say, well, let's try this or let's try that or let's try that. But when you realize that often that approach doesn't get you to where you want to go, then you start looking for something more systematic. And so I remember process mapping was one of my first loves. And I was like, guys, let's just draw out what we did. Like, let's draw it out and then figure out where did that not work. And so I think when you help to see people and where the problems are at, then that can really highlight where you need to go and where you need to focus your efforts.
Yeah, that's great. So in with Medical Teams International, I also see that you've got kind of stories from all over the map. So I'd really like to start with how do you decide where you're deployed and where are you going to be to apply and to assist where is needed?
Yeah. So a lot of my work, I actually get to work from home in my Kampala office, but I get to do a lot of training and coaching, probably similar to Gemma, right? Gemma sits across the pond, but she gets to coach the ones doing the hands-on work. And so one thing that I have just loved seeing in recent months is I was talking to our nutrition manager in Ethiopia, and she's like, I want to tell you the story. Can I tell you the story? I was like, yeah, because anytime someone gets excited about continuous improvement, you know, you want to hear about it. And she's like, so listen, we recently took over a nutrition program in rural Ethiopia that another NGO had been running. But the problem was 25% of those homes were in villages that had no road access. And so we were asked to still make sure these kids got into the nutrition program and whatnot. So we asked them, we said, okay, how did those families get nutrition supplies? Like, there are no roads. And they said, oh no, the other partner asked them to walk. They had to walk, you know, up to 8 hours a day to go collect supplies. And we were like, absolutely not. Like, that is not show respect for people. You know, one of the highest continuous improvement values. And so we looked around and we said, what do people already do? Because we're not going to build roads. We can't do, you know, big fancy innovations, but what do people do to get the things they need home? And the obvious answer became pack animals. You use donkeys. And so we said, okay, can we meet with local donkey owners? Can we ask them, hey, can we contract you to carry nutrition supplies? And they said, yeah, sounds great to us. You know, we'll make money. So then our procurement and our finance team said, that sounds great. Where's the receipt? And we're like, donkey owners don't give receipts. Like, that's not how this works. So we decided to make a template that we could give the donkey owners. They could fill out the receipt, hand it back to us. And so now 100% of those villages get nutrition supplies. And she was telling me, she's like, Jennifer, it's even crazy this week. When you see what's happening globally with fuel shortages, we're having issues in other areas of the country getting nutrition supplies. She's like, not there. Everything's getting in on donkeys. Like, they're running just fine. And so you see how these like really local solutions actually work and are very practical for people.
This is such a great example of using, you know, creativity to solve a problem, where you've got these huge constraints, these huge things limiting you, literally, like you don't have a road. But there's also this enormous need. You've got all these huge constraints, but also a huge need. I wonder, do you think that fuels the creativity, that fuels the problem solving?
Yes, I think it does, because like when you know your work is a matter of life or death, it's really not an option to not work on the problem. You know, in some other spheres, it's like, it could be better. We could just muddle on through it. But it's like, if someone's not getting nutrition supplies or someone's not getting blood supplies, like that's a big problem. And that's what we had happen in Tanzania. It was like, we do not have enough blood for blood transfusions. And we had been asking folks as a result of that to say, hey, bring your own donor. Well, that's super hard. What if you don't know someone with your blood type? What if your neighbor or relative is not willing to donate blood? Like, then you can't get the services you need. And so we said, that's not how we're going to do this. And so there was a couple of things as we looked at that to say, how do we boost the blood supply? And we realized that, you know, for cultural reasons or religious reasons, a lot of people didn't know the importance of it, or maybe they were hesitant about it. And also people were telling us, like, why? Why should I go do that? Like, I could, but there's really no incentive. And so we did a couple of things. So one, we said, okay, we're going to up the refreshments. You get a kilo of rice, you're going to get water, you're going to get sugar, you're going to get biscuits, like things people actually need. And it might seem small from a Western perspective to think that that's motivating enough, but it helps for sure. And then from that cultural and community-minded sense, we started talking to the local faith communities, because in a lot of our communities, faith plays a huge role and those leaders have a lot of influence. And so we said, can we come into your services? Can we talk about the importance of blood donation? Can we talk about how it's for good medically? You know, it's not anything to do with, you know, negative cultural practices where, you know, you don't want to be seen as practicing something, you know, outside the faith. So by building and relying on those relationships, we were able to go into churches, for instance, and say, hey, this is why you should donate blood. And after the service, we're going to have a blood drive donation. And so by tackling the problem from multiple areas, we were able to get enough blood supply in the camp. And then the flip side, we looked at supply and we're like, but why do we need so many transfusions? And the answer was malaria. When you have a lot of malaria, people can then become anemic and need transfusions. So we partnered with another NGO to say, hey, let's get bed nets out to people. Let's get insecticides out. And in the areas we did that, the demand for blood dropped dramatically because there was also less malaria.
Jennifer, I mean, I love these stories and I love your application to principles that we use, and we use people principles a lot. But I'm curious, in your role kind of as a leader of other folks, how do you apply continuous learning, continuous improvement, and how do you get your team to buy into that and use those resources?
Yeah, I think that is the challenge of continuous improvement leaders everywhere, right? Like, I don't think anyone just walked in and on day one, everyone believed them and you were good to go. So here's maybe the story I'll tell, is that I have been around medical teams for better part of 8 years. And many years ago, I shifted into a new department. So as I got to know those managers, I was like, hey, tell me about a typical day. You know, what types of problems do you solve, whatnot? And this manager said, you know, I spend a lot of time answering questions from my staff and advising them on what to do, and then looking back on my emails on how we handled that thing last year. And right away, my continuous improvement hat was like, oh, there are not standards in some areas. And that is why this manager is overwhelmed. And the way they explained it, they were overwhelmed because so much they had to be the final answer giver. And so we have had been on a long journey, and it's not just me, it's many others, but of building more SOPs, building more manuals, and saying, you know, hey, not every situation actually is so unique. You can actually have a baseline standard and build upon that. And so I think we have continuous improvement classes that we run, but we're also just getting more and more managers who start to realize this language, to realize the language of PDCA, and realize, you know, hey, we can build standards and we're not going to get everything fixed right at once. You know, we used to use a lot of pilot language. Well, this is just the pilot, as if one day we would finally have it all figured out. And I realize now we're using more language of, well, this will iterate. We're just going to try this. And I love that because I'm like, we don't want to be in pilot mode for 9 months. Like, it's just that we are constantly building. And so I see that changing across the org. Which is
yeah, cool. I want to dig in there just a little bit more because we talk about standards too. And again, I think your experience where the needs are so great and where the resources are so slim,
right.
How do you create a standard that people see as not rigid, that people see as flexible? And I'm just curious how you think about that today, because we struggle with the same thing.
Sure. So one thing I admire so much in this industry is humanitarians are amazing firefighters, right? Like at any minute, something could go wrong or is going wrong and you have to pivot. And so I learned that I am surrounded by people who are incredibly creative and incredibly flexible. And if you are a very rigid person, it is kind of hard for you to work in this industry. But as you say, then, like, there does need to be standards. So teaching that standards are the foundation of agility, right? And helping people to see, like, hey, if we have a quieter month, this is the month we're really going to work on developing that standard. Because we know 6 months from now, we're going to need to implement that. We're going to need to, like, tweak it and adapt it and flex it to actually meet the need. But at least right now, we know we're all starting at a base foundation. And so that has been extremely helpful to get people to realize, like, it feels like going slower now, but in the future, we're going to have so many less conversations because you're just going to be able to pick up and run because you know it's approved, you know it's the way to do it, you know we build out the infrastructure for it. And so I think that really helps some people understand those structures are not there to hold you back, or maybe it's a minimum skeleton, like, hey, all of our systems need to have ABCD, but you get to decide how to do ABCD. You know, that's the way that we give flexibility to our country offices.
Yeah, and building off of that, I mean, you've got your team that are helping do humanitarian work, but you've also got to get, you talked a little bit about this, but I'm wondering if you'll expand on the importance of getting community acceptance into, you know, because again, there can be a set of systems and standards that are appropriate for the diverse communities that you serve. So
right.
how do you balance and do both in order to get the right outcomes?
Yeah. So I bet you've had this too, right? Where you have a project team come up with something and you're like, we think this will work great. And this makes a lot of sense. And the process map is so clean. And you know, it's going to be excellent. And then you roll it out to people and people don't like it. And you're like, but guys, this is good. And this works and it will work, you know? So we have the same things happen here. And one example I can think of is in our health facilities in Uganda, they are different levels of care, so different sizes, right? How complex of things we can handle. And so we have a process for knowing when we need to refer someone to a higher level facility. It's usually a little bit further away, so that's not going to be the first place someone will go. And just like any good, you know, healthcare system, we have patient feedback systems that we do. And we realized we were getting hundreds of complaints a week about this referral system. And we're like, what is going on? Like, we didn't think it was that bad. And so first we checked and we said, let's check our process. Like, are we running our process according to standards? And we investigated with staff. We were in the clinics. Yes. Okay. We are correctly referring the right cases up. So then we're like, but still people are not happy. So we talked to the community and we said, you know, help us understand, why does it seem like a lot of you are not happy with this? And what they felt like is that we were showing favoritism. Their understanding of the referral process was that if we referred someone up, we were treating them better and saying like, oh, let's give you the better level of care, which was not it at all. It was just, it was too complex of a case to handle at this facility. So we could have just had one meeting and be like, oh no, you're wrong. Like, you don't have it right. But that wasn't going to solve it. And so we did a couple of things. One, we created a referral committee with community leaders and our staff. So that way it was a continual group talking about the referral process, looking at examples of cases. So that way staff in the community knew they were represented by these members and they could learn more about how the system worked. And then secondly, we decided, well, instead of just having the feedback box where you drop in your complaint or you have a phone call hotline, let's do regular listening sessions. Let's come together. Let's hear your concerns. Let's talk about them. And over time, those complaints drop dramatically. And so then that allows us to actually focus on the feedback where we do need to be improving our systems, right? And so I think it just shows how much trust in your standards and your continuous improvement efforts matter, because you can design the best, prettiest thing in the world, but if people don't understand it, then it's not going to get utilized the way you want.
That's beautiful. And you're really demonstrating humility and, you know, not just saying, no, that's the way it is and trying to explain it, but actually being so respectful and listening to your customers and, you know, helping designing a system that really works for them and that they understand. It's beautiful. I wanted to ask Jennifer about, you know, this is not easy work and CI is never easy work. But this really isn't in both the environment for the people, the input for the people working, but also the different situations and the dynamics around it all. So what really motivates you and some of the people who you're working with, do you think, to keep going in this tough environment?
Yeah, great question. So one thing that I think is really interesting is the majority of our work is done by local staff. So we are not an organization that has lots of expatriates being sent to other countries. Certainly for a few roles, you need that. But mostly it's neighbors serving neighbors. So I think on one hand, you have a group of people who care about the health of their neighbors, which is fascinating, whether that's someone from their own culture or that's a migrant, someone who has had to come into their community. Maybe they were displaced by natural disaster or by a political situation. And so I think because staff are willing to work in very remote areas, often that shows a very high level of commitment of wanting to be able to care for their neighbor. We are a faith-based organization as well, so certainly not all of our staff are from the Christian faith. Of course, in Sudan, most of our staff would be from the Muslim faith. But I think whatever faith tradition you have, typically there is a sense of caring for others. And so you combine that with probably the natural heart of a healthcare worker. I think you would see that at Baptist too. Like, you want to see people get well. And so I think it's really lovely when people see they can make a difference in that way.
I also want to touch on the fact that sometimes you are in very critical and dangerous situations. And right. So how do you balance like the need to serve the people that are in desperate need, but also protect your team? So I'm curious about like making sure that you think about staff safety and I'm wondering if you have anything you could share there.
Yeah, very much so. I would say, you know, we see that especially a lot in Ethiopia and Sudan and Ukraine, especially anywhere that we run mobile medical units. Those are some sort of vehicle that is bringing medical care to people based on where the care is needed, you know, in a given month. And so I'm thinking of one story from Ukraine. We had our security manager who had been going through continuous improvement classes, and we asked them, "Can you do a PDSA project?" And we tried to tell them, like, it can be small, y'all. It doesn't have to be this major, massive thing. Like, you just need to get people practicing PDSA. And so we had also been teaching about the concepts of 5S. And so he's like, "You know what? People have told me that my daily security updates are a bit long and hard to grasp at a glance." And he's like, "That's a problem because I'm trying to literally keep my staff safe in Ukraine. They need to know, can we run the mobile medical unit in that area today, or do we need to pivot? Do we need to go into the bunkers, or do we not need to?" And so by using 5S, he really worked to streamline the information he was sending, to send it in a very easy to scan way, to use a few more like graphics. So that way, at a glance, those staff could know for the day what their movements needed to be. And I remember sometimes, even during the classes, my Ukraine staff were calling in from their bunkers. And I was like, "Can you imagine? Like, that is where you're practicing continuous improvement, when you are literally in a place of conflict and you're trying to keep yourself safe, but you're keeping others safe as well." And so I thought that was just a beautiful example of using continuous improvement to look out for your community and your staff.
Yeah, that's a wonderful example.
I just want to piggyback on that a bit, Jennifer. Of how do you support those staff who are having to do that problem solving, to do that all that continuous improvement work, when they must be under a real sense of stress, either not feeling safe or being concerned about their patients or the people around them? It seems to me they must be under, and we talk about how we can't necessarily be creative or problem solve so easily if we're stressed. So how do you kind of support them to manage that?
So I think on one hand, there is a layered system in place. So our headquarters has a lot of staff who are essentially in kind of an advisory role. So that way, people don't feel on their own, right? It's not like in this Ukraine example, it's not like he fully had to figure that all on his own. He could chat to the global safety and security advisor. He could get feedback. They could get feedback from the other security managers in other countries. And so there's been some really nice kind of communities of practice that have formed, because it's like, hey, we're all doing the same function in different countries. And certainly there's different challenges we each face, but there's also a lot of similarities, actually. And so I think those communities of practice have been a really nice way for people to feel supported and to feel like they have ownership. And then over time, that actually helps standardize our process, right? Like, when I'm sharing a best practice from one country and you're adopting it in this country, now we're starting to harmonize how we do things. So it doesn't feel like you're so alone. Even if you are like the single highest security manager, you have other security managers, and then that feeds down to the staff below.
That's wonderful. So that net, there's like a network, there's
Correct.
relationships, but there's also that communication and support for each other. That's really wonderful.
Yeah, I really love this concept of kind of building community. And Jennifer, it's amazing to me that, to hear you talk about and hear you describe some of the same issues that we're dealing with in a first world country in kind of coaching and improvement here at Baptist. But I love this also, this important link to how similar our work is, and again, how we can collaborate and support and kind of lend to each other. And I know you get to do that a lot with Gemma, but I think that you've been able to share today already some really key things that I think our listeners will love to hear because they're struggling with some of the similar things. So I'm curious, Gemma, for you and Jennifer, in your networks of sharing and kind of discussing, do you see that happen a lot? And how do you continue to match people with like personalities, skills, et cetera, by way of continuing to support and encourage folks to use the tried and true ways that we can sustain improvement?
So Jennifer and I initially met. I think you joined. Did you join the KGG, Jennifer? So
You did.
Jennifer is a Kata Girl Geek. She's part of our global community for women learning about Kata and scientific thinking. And as the co-founder of that group, I get to put people together in learning groups, and so I get to pair people up. Now, that's quite a tricky job because I'm usually looking, I might have a pool of 20, 24, up to 30 women, and I'm trying to put them together in groups. So usually, Brad, I'm thinking about where people's skill level is and kind of where they, what they are trying to achieve in terms of whether they are learning or they are learning to coach. So I'm not often really thinking about the details that you were talking about. I think that that tends to happen naturally, where people build connection and then, you know, and then they sort of start to build these little mini communities within our community. But I think one of the beautiful things about it is people connecting across the world in different department, different industries, different communities, and then coming together and sharing. Jennifer is incredibly generous within the KGG of sharing her experience and her stories and coaching other people. And that's really what makes that community work.
Yeah. And Jennifer, I want to share a personal story, if you don't mind. I, you know, I got into healthcare to be of service to others. And that was really built off of international service projects like some of what you've described.
Very
so,
cool.
You know, now 25 years in working in the U.S. healthcare system, but really that seed was planted in international service years and years ago. And so coming full circle, I'm going to get to take my family on an international service project this summer.
Wow.
I'm very excited about that. And so I love hearing about applying, you know, the same things that we use every day here in our first world problems that you're applying in ways that I can't describe how much more meaningful that is in the work that you're doing day in and day out. So we really are grateful for not only for your stories and your sharing, but grateful that you're getting to apply some continuous improvement as you do it.
Yeah. And you know what's so cool, Brad, is like, I think as you go on those service trips, then you see, now maybe you can't have, you know, the same, you know, Baptist level quality healthcare all over the world in a refugee settlement, but still some of those core tenets of healthcare are so important. Like I'm thinking that in Colombia, we were working in a clinic, and in that clinic, they previously didn't allow women to have a partner with them during childbirth. But that was one of the feedback that staff or patients were giving of like, can't I bring someone into the delivery room? And so it was part of a CI project. And then in that hospital, for the first time, women were able to have a companion during childbirth. And so you see these things that are best practices in healthcare can be shared all over the world. And so I think that's really lovely when you realize it's actually not so different, you know, wherever you are.
Yeah. And I want to, Jennifer, I want to talk for another minute about that and just because it's also in the people principles. We talk
yes.
about those a lot and we really harp on that, but the principles of respect and humility and empathy mm-hmm. to build trust are maybe even more important in third world countries or where humanitarian need is the greatest. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you will talk about how do you make sure you're building trust so you can propose something that may be a little bit different than what they're accustomed to?
Yeah. Yeah. So if I jump off that example, in Colombia, they actually have a very strong national system. So it was not an area that we needed to run our own clinics, which sometimes we do need to do that. But it was more so the access for Venezuelan migrants to getting into the healthcare system because there were certain forms and procedures you had to go through. And so our work in that country was predominantly about how can we partner with local clinics? How can we ensure that, A, they're a very good clinic, but B, then we can tell migrants about it, say, hey, when you need healthcare, here's where you can go. Here's, you know, how you get in and here's how you'll be treated. And so it was a two-way street where one, we needed to introduce people to the clinics, but also sometimes we were finding, you know, if people don't understand the migrant situation or whatever, maybe they were not as inclusive as they needed to be. So there was coaching done and capacity building done with the staff to say, hey, you know, we treat everyone fairly in healthcare. You know, these people have needs just like anyone else. And so you're really right that it is a two-way street of building relationships. And then I think we see that in other countries too, because we try to affect even at the national level with policies, with medical supply chains to say like, hey, we need to be able to import these medicines. Like, what are we doing to make sure that medicines can get into countries? And you don't just rock up one day and say that. There's a huge amount of relationship building that has to happen. And so I know that maybe that's not as exciting of work, kind of that background behind the scenes rapport building, but it actually then can affect millions of people when systems work well.
Yeah, Jennifer, I'm curious if you'll again share a little bit about how can our listeners find out a little bit more about Medical Teams International and how can we even offer some support there. If somebody wanted to get involved or support the cause, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that would be great. So as I mentioned, we are funded both through governments and the UN, but also through private individuals, corporations, foundations, and whatnot. We have a really cool partnership with the health system near our headquarters where they give donated medical supplies that then get shipped all over the world. So if you're involved in something like that, we could partner that way. Or as an individual, of course, we always want more people hearing about the story. And if you're able to give, that's lovely as well. So medicalteams.org is our website, and you can certainly find everything there. Thanks, Brad.
Well, Jennifer, that was fantastic. And rarely do I do this so quickly, but I'm going to now. I'm going to ask you to come back on in the near future.
Okay.
I think your energy is contagious. I think you have a mission that's focused. And the thing I love about what you're doing is sometimes I'm always concerned about, do continuous improvement groups practice what they promote? It tends to be something that keeps me up at night. And in your world, if you're not practicing what you promote, there are consequences immediately. And just so grateful for the work you do, so thankful for the work you do. And we look forward to you coming back on Connecting the Dots podcast.
That sounds great, Skip. Thank you.
Awesome.